You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, a guest argues that the arts and culture that add beauty to our lives are also critical to science, technology, and the economy as a whole.
First, weather can have a big impact on daily life and on the economy. And that was certainly true this year, with dramatic and devastating storms and wildfires affecting the U.S. and its territories from north to south, east to west.
Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com, and he's based here in Wisconsin. We asked him to take a look back at the year in weather with us. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
So for a layperson, this seemed like an unprecedented year of storms, was it?
Well, certainly the hurricane season lived up to that billing. Of course, we don't have the final damage tolls in, and unfortunately in some parts of the Caribbean, we don't even have final death tolls in. But yes, it certainly looks like one of the most destructive hurricane seasons in the Atlantic Basin that we've ever seen. And it featured three Category 4 U.S. landfalls, so I think by the time all the tabulations come in from the economists and the insurance industry, it will be one of the most destructive on record.
Weather.com writes that September was the busiest month of hurricane activity ever, and that 2017 was in the top 10 most active Atlantic hurricane seasons recorded. How much did we exceed usual norms or past records?
Well, it's interesting. If you looked at the entire season as a whole, and you looked at every month of the hurricane season, and you just went month by month, really, it was pretty much just September, and that was it. I mean, it was really a fairly benign average season, at least going through August. Of course, then we had Harvey in late August that made up for that. But when we had to September, it was just an onslaught, one after another. Of course, we had Irma, a long-track Category 5 hurricane. And then we had Maria right behind that. And, oh, by the way, probably the one hurricane most people will forget, Hurricane Nate, made landfall along the northern Gulf Coast in early October. So It was just a very compressed period where we just had this hyperactivity in the Atlantic Basin. And, unfortunately, a lot of those hurricanes hit land.
Did it make matters worse that this season came on the heels of what you referred to as a U.S. major hurricane drought of 12 years? Or did that just change our perceptions of it?
Well, it's a good question. It's partly a perception. Now, when you hear the word major, it's a little bit misleading when it comes to hurricanes. But by major hurricanes, we mean those that are Category 3 or stronger. And it has been since the middle of the last decade since we had a Category 3 U.S. landfall, which is officially meteorologists called major hurricanes. The problem is you don't need a Category 3 hurricane to be a, quote, major impact. So, for instance, Superstorm Sandy, which had officially not even made landfall as a hurricane, it was called a post-tropical system once it made landfall. I don't think anybody on the Jersey Shore wouldn't call that a major event for them. And in 2008, we had Hurricane Ike, which technically was not a major hurricane because it was, quote, only a Category 2 when it made landfall along the Texas coast in 2008. But that was highly destructive in the Houston and Galveston areas. So, you know, the major hurricane drought is kind of misleading in that it basically means we hadn't had a Category 3 or stronger landfall along the U.S. coastline in such a long time, over many, many years. And that is just statistically unusual. And unfortunately, we paid the price for it this year.
Jonathan, you mentioned that we don't even have final death tolls for these horrific hurricanes and their impact, let alone the economic totals. But what you know as a meteorologist and having seen major storms before, given the pictures, the images we've seen from Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and Barbuda, what caused that incredible amount of devastation? Was it in part the infrastructure that was there, or were these storms just so outside of what we're used to building to sustain against?
Well, it's really a combination of all those factors. You know, you can go through the historical record and you can find some intense hurricanes that just through the steering flow in the atmosphere never made a landfall and stayed safely out over the open Atlantic Ocean. And thank goodness that they didn't. But unfortunately, this year we had a combination of intense hurricanes, Category 5 hurricanes, that unfortunately took a track that took them right through the northern Leeward Islands in the Caribbean and then right through the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, among other locations, including say, parts of Cuba, with, as we saw with Hurricane Irma. So it's really a combination. We had these intense hurricanes, and unfortunately, the steering patterns in the atmosphere at the time these intense hurricanes were there steered them toward land instead of steering them out to sea. Mm. And as a result, we had the devastation that we saw.
Let's move on to what seems in some ways like the opposite type of weather disaster, fires. How did 2017 stack up on that count?
Well, you know, of course, all the attention goes right to California. And really, it was a combination of factors in California that triggered such a devastating fire season there. Number one, oddly enough, you know, they had a very, very wet season last winter. In fact, they had a record wet season for the state, which sounds ridiculous, right? If you have a record wet season, mm-hmm. how can they be having all these wildfires?
Especially because they'd had drought for so many years.
Yeah, that's right. It really punctured a hole in that, you know, at least in the in some drought indicators. But what happened is you triggered all this undergrowth that grew in response to all that precipitation. And unfortunately, California has a distinct dry season from, say, May through, say, the first half of October. It typically doesn't rain there. So all that vegetation dries out. When you have all that fresh vegetation that just grew from the previous winter's rains, all of a sudden you have all that fuel that can burn. And then you throw on top of California the fact that in the fall and here so far through the first half of December, they haven't had much precipitation at all, especially in Southern California. So now it's extremely dry. You have all that extra growth, and then you throw Santa Ana winds, which typically happen in the fall and early winter, even into the spring months sometimes, and you just had a recipe for a disaster.
I wanted to ask you about that, Jonathan, because we do hear a lot on the news about wind conditions and how they either help or hinder efforts to contain the blazes. And as you said, we hear about the Santa Ana winds. What are those winds? Why do they have their own name?
Well, the Santa Ana winds, and there's also a similar wind in Northern California and parts of the Bay Area called the Diablo winds. And they're basically winds that blow from the land to the sea, so they blow offshore. And because they blow offshore, they're dry winds. And frequently, those winds are also hot winds. So, you know, if you picture a wildfire that is either already burning or that starts suddenly, as we saw in parts of the Napa Valley of California in October, you have a fire that's already burning, and then you throw those, you know, 60 plus mile per hour wind gusts on it, those offshore Santa Ana or Diablo winds, and it just can whip this small fire into a fast spreading firestorm that leaves people in its path with very little time to evacuate. You know, a truly frightening sight, considering, especially in Northern California, some of those wildfires in the Napa Valley occurred during the overnight hours, and people were sleeping and probably were completely unaware of that happening. So, it's a very dangerous recipe, and unfortunately, this year all the ingredients were there.
Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com, and he's based here in Wisconsin. He's with us to take a look back at the year in weather.
And we'll pick up the conversation in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're with us on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with meteorologist Jonathan Erdman about the year in weather. Jonathan, we're just kind of getting into the first few weeks of winter here in Wisconsin, but there were some interesting and unusual winter weather events earlier this year, the end of the last winter season. Winter tornado outbreaks in Georgia, Missouri, and Minnesota in the first quarter of the year. I think of tornadoes as warm weather phenomena. What happened there?
Well, that's true. That's usually the last thing on our minds here in Wisconsin are tornadoes in winter. We usually have other concerns to deal with in the winter. But really, in the rest of the country, you know, there are times of year where we typically see many more tornadoes in certain areas, like the Central Plain states is typically in the spring months. Or, you know, in Wisconsin, usually it's June is our peak tornado month, followed by July, May, and August. But what happens in other parts of the country, especially in the southern United States, is whenever the conditions are right for severe thunderstorms, it doesn't matter what the calendar says. And unfortunately, in late January of 2017, we had a big tornado outbreak in the Deep South, which set a state record in Georgia, one of the largest winter outbreaks on record. There was a long track tornado that tracked near Albany, Georgia. And, you know, that was just one of the prominent winter tornado outbreaks. There was another one further north in parts of Missouri and Illinois right around the end of February and the beginning of March, where there were 82 tornadoes spawned in that outbreak. And then, you know, for us, you know, closer to home, even weirder is that, you know, officially it was still winter, but in around March 6th to the 8th, there was actually an upper Midwest tornado outbreak that had the earliest in the calendar tornadoes on record for the state of Minnesota. So there was areas just near and around the Minneapolis-St. Paul area that actually had some tornadoes spawned from that. So really, it doesn't matter what the calendar says. If the conditions are right for severe thunderstorms, you can get severe thunderstorms and tornadoes really any time of year, even into parts of the upper Midwest.
So on the other side, the winter storm Benji brought snow to areas very unused to it, like South Texas, the Florida Panhandle, and Louisiana all the way to Georgia. What created winter storm Benji that would bring snow to those areas?
Well, if I had to pick one of the top stories of the year, this may be actually be my favorite. You know, it's we can get these type of setups even in the deep south in December, January, February. And, of course, first you need the cold air. And there was a you know, tremendous surge of cold air that plunged all the way down into northern Mexico and plunged all the way down into parts of the northern Gulf Coast. And then over the top of that cold air, we had an active jet stream with a prominent storm system that pivoted out of northern Mexico and frankly surprised a lot of us meteorologists with the amount of snow that it was producing. So far south, I mean, we had accumulating snow in Brownsville, Texas, which if you do a web search on where Brownsville, Texas is, that's about as far south as you can go in the lower 48 other than the Florida Keys. Mm-hmm. It's about the same latitude as Miami. And they saw, you know, their first measurable snow since Christmas 2004 and only the third time it had happened there in records dating to the late 1800s. So, you know, between the South Texas snow and then also seeing some snow that fell in the western Florida panhandle, that was one of the most bizarre winter storms that I have seen. And, you know, if that wasn't enough, there were parts of the northwest side of the Atlanta metro area that picked up a foot of snow.
Wow.
Which, for them, matched the superstorm of March 1993, which is legendary in those parts of the country. Pretty much everybody there references that storm as the storm of record. And that knocked out power for several days for some folks.
Well, Colorado is certainly used to winter weather, but there was a hailstorm in Denver that NOAA said was the most expensive hailstorm in Colorado history and had baseball-sized hail. How in the world does baseball-sized hail form?
Well, basically, hail forms in a thunderstorm when the hailstone is being suspended by an updraft, this upward current of moving air in a thunderstorm. And it just gets blasted by sheets of water, which then freeze onto the hailstone. Eventually, the hailstone grows big enough where it just the updraft can't support its weight, and it falls to the ground. And so if you can imagine a large city being pelted by hailstones up to baseball size, you can imagine the amount of damage that would do to vehicles, to homes. You know, in Denver's case, there was a shopping mall that had skylights busted out.
Oh, wow.
So this is easily an over $1 billion storm. And again, the final economic tolls and data is not out yet, but this is easily an $1 billion storm.
We're talking with senior meteorologist Jonathan Erdman from weather.com about the year in weather for 2017. Jonathan, were there any other weather events that might not have made a top 10 list, but were still significant?
There sure were. I wish we had a top 20 list this time because there were a lot of very interesting events. For instance, one of the hardest hit cities during last winter was actually Portland, Oregon. And you don't really think of snow and ice when you think of the Pacific Northwest outside of the Cascades, but Portland had its biggest snowstorm in 22 years. Last winter, and that pretty much snarled the city, which is quite hilly, for several days. You know, and that was just one storm that they had. They had several winter weather events last winter that, you know, arguably when we looked at the winter as a whole, and I said, well, which city has had it worse this winter? I put Portland right near the top. Other than that, there was a a fairly healthy, strange fall flood events that swamped parts of northern New Hampshire and Maine right around Halloween, sometime in October. And that was also accompanied by some strong winds that also knocked out power to hundreds of thousands of residents in parts of northern New England. In fact, I think one of the power companies in central Maine said it was one of their biggest outage events in years. So that was a bit of a strange event. And then finally, we had a pretty significant flash drought. And by the way, we use the term flash drought to say the drought that develops relatively quickly in parts of the northern plains and Montana and the western Dakotas that flared up pretty quickly. So, yeah, it was a pretty active year in 2017 in many accounts.
There was a scientific and technological breakthrough in 2017 that you're pretty excited about that could have some big implications for atmospheric science going forward. What was that?
Well, in late November 2016, the GOES-16 satellite was launched into space, and then by January of 2017, it started sending back its first images. And it's just hard to overemphasize what a game changer this is for the field of meteorology. The resolution is much, much higher. The spatial resolution is much, much higher, and it can scan the Earth as frequently as every 30 seconds. And so the imagery that GOES-16 was sending out from hurricanes, including the big three of Harvey, Irma, and Maria, from wildfires, from severe thunderstorms, was just spectacular. And, you know, this is going to help the field of meteorology and forecasting for years to come. And it's a real treat that some scientists at the University of Wisconsin played a very big role in the launch and the implementation of GOES-16 satellite imagery. So that was a very positive thing in 2017.
So as we wrap up, Jonathan, any predictions on what 2018 might bring weather-wise?
Well, we have a phenomenon in place called La Nina, and that's basically a periodic cooling of the equatorial Pacific waters that tends to have feedback into the atmosphere. Now, it's not the only thing, but in general, most La Nina winters here in Wisconsin tend to be maybe a little colder than average and maybe a little snowier than average. So we might see a bit of a snowier winter heading through January and February and into March. Other thing to keep in mind is that with that La Nina in place, it'll eventually weaken, but when that is already in place, unfortunately, it could mean another active hurricane season is ahead for 2018. Now, of course, we can't really tell you if any of those storms and hurricanes will hit land this far out, but again, there is concern that we could have another active season ahead.
Well, Jonathan, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Erdman is a senior meteorologist at weather.com based here in Wisconsin. He joined us to take a look back at the year in weather.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Winter is full of its ups and downs, both in our moods and in the temperatures. Helene Phelps reminds us what's so wonderful about these dips and swings.
In summertime, the terms dip and swing set a 17-foot canoe in motion, dodging boulders and down trees on riverways, or gliding into good fishing territory on inland lakes in Wisconsin's far north. In wintertime, it's the temperature that swings and dips wildly in waves and colors on the landscape and on the evening news. Arctic air masses are part of this season's waltz, blasting through Canadian provinces and on down through the Dakotas and Minnesota before it whooshes through my neck of the woods near Brule to continue its due course. When temperatures drop below the invisible below zero mark, it's a frosty reminder that we really do live in the north. Today begins the downward creep from yesterday's fresh snow and balmy 32-degree breezes. Now dropping to 11 degrees with a wind chill of -2, the new morning is gray and white. The day is growing older and colder. The neighborhood bird feeders beckon chickadees by the dozen, nuthatches too, and all manner of woodpeckers. They all take turns, but they are messy. Dropped seed is the siren call for wild turkeys lurking near. These funny-looking creatures actually run across the open when they see smaller breeds feeding. They are smart, it seems, and know when the frozen ground will offer speckles of sunflower and millet. This is winter entertainment at its best. But mostly, in northern Wisconsin, our neighbors are fur-covered and four-legged. The crisscross tracks of deer, herding and hiding out, keeping warm, protecting each other with their thermal overcoats. The squat bobcat that steps lightly so near the woodshed, but is never ever seen. The enormous porcupine balanced on the tip-top limb of the virgin white pine near the creek. He is likely on the lookout for spring. The coyotes and eagles circling land and air for a free lunch. All these and smaller critters, too, choose, like me, not to relocate when the season dips to cold and white. Wood stoves crackle and hiss, transforming last year's oak into soft gray ash. The aroma of chimney smoke fills us with dreams of green arching up out of snowbanks. April or May, it's anyone's guess when the first ephemerals will appear. But we are a patient bunch. In northern Wisconsin, we all bundle up and hunker down. We ski and snowshoe and hope the forest creatures are as snug and safe as hibernating humans. We measure our days in pea soup and pages turned, short walks and warming up during downy naps. And we wear fat socks.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook.
Coming up after the news, training in the humanities is often treated as an enrichment, but not as important or serious as studying engineering, science, or maybe business. Our next guest argues that, in fact, the humanities are critical for all of those fields. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Farrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, find out about great events in your area, and get the latest from the WPR News Department. Check it all out now at WPR.org.
Now, federal agencies like the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities are often in the crosshairs for lawmakers who wonder if it's a good use of valuable taxpayer money and if the benefit to the country justifies the expense.
Our next guest says cuts to federal funding for the arts and humanities would be a huge blow to not just the arts community, but to the American economy and our ability to compete in the global marketplace.
Christian Maspier joins us now. He's the author of Sensemaking, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. He's the co-founder and senior partner of Red Associates, a strategy consulting company based in the human sciences. Christian, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's talk about the age of the algorithm. We hear all the time how big data is going to help companies improve our lives at a personal level, at the economic level. Are we in the age of the algorithm?
I think we're in the age of talking a lot about it. It seems like there's more talk about it than there really are big data things. I mean, I've been working in the business world and in the advanced sort of analytics space for a long time, and I'm yet to see really great solutions based on it. But sure, it's a time where we have access to data that we didn't have access to before, and we're just still organizing it and making sense of it.
And at the same time, we hear that the humanities maybe aren't as important, arts aren't, colleges should focus more on business and data analysis, things like that. We need less, fewer programs in the humanities. Are we, as a culture, turning against things like the arts and the humanities at the same time?
Unfortunately, I think so, and that's why I wrote a book about it. I was not, I mean, I'm, as you can hear on my quaint accent, I'm not from America. I'm from Denmark, and when I arrived here a decade ago, I was rather surprised by sort of the general tone in the debate that if you, I mean, I heard a lot that if you were studying, say, history or English or something like that, you were looking at a future of making hamburgers or something like that in a job that wasn't what you sort of originally hoped it would be. And I don't think that's the case. I know it isn't the case. And I think that right now we're in the middle of another sort of round of cutting down on essential components of any society. But also what I want to say in my latest book is that there are very practical skills coming out of the humanities. Not just, it's a delightful thing to listen to music and hear stories and look at art, but it's also a skill of engaging with other people and other cultures, and that's a skill that is necessary for competitiveness and for businesses and so on.
Yeah, talk more about how understanding the humanities, appreciating them. You say this, we're not talking about soft skills. These are hard skills that we need in the business world if we're going to innovate and compete. How connect the dots for us.
Right. So let's say you are in an automaker in Michigan, and you are living among people that are like you, and you want to make vehicles for, say, the Brazilian market or for the Western Chinese market or for Indonesia. And they live different lives there. They live different. It's maybe the first time a family has gotten together and bought a vehicle, and it's a big deal for them, which is different from buying your 57th, you know, family vehicle in your family if you come from a place like Michigan. So understanding what that situation is like is absolutely crucial to organize the components of the car, how it's designed, how you think about features and so on. So this engagement with other people and understanding what's going on in their life is absolutely crucial if you make software or cars or telecom services or radio. Whatever you, whenever you want to sell something to people or want to design something to people that are not like you, you need to engage in their world and their life. And the humanities is not the only place, but it certainly is a place, and I would say the best place, to train yourself in understanding what something somebody else's life is like. So if you study paintings from the 1920s in France, you will have to put yourself into the position of somebody living like they did then and seeing what they thought was beautiful and what was right and what was wrong and so on. So, and the same goes with if you listen to music from China that's 400 years old, you will have to experience the world as they saw it then. So it's sort of a training ground. The humanities is a training ground to thinking like someone that figures out what other people need and what will be helpful and how to talk to them and so on. So it's a fundamental condition of business, and right now we're undermining it.
Talking to Christian Massberg, talking about his new book, Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. He says we need more, not less, focus on the humanities and the arts, not because they're nice and fun, but because they're crucial to our economic success, to our creativity, our ability to innovate. Christian, can you point toward companies that maybe have gone wrong by not appreciating these skills that we can get from the humanities?
Right. I think, I mean, unfortunately, if you take a walk down the aisle of any supermarket or if you look at a lot of the products that are being produced, they are not made with much sophistication in terms of understanding people. But there are some companies that are really good at it, but we can get back to that. But if you take, I mean, a couple of days ago, there was a big scandal that YouTube, which is a Google company, was promoting people's advertising. So basically people that pay YouTube to put advertising on the channels, but doing it around very disturbing websites. So they had no ability to see, so the algorithm that they were using to place ads had no ability to see what was seen in our culture as a reasonable website to place things on and what wasn't. It was just following people. So without the contextual understanding of what is reasonable and what is good taste in our society, you can end up placing your customers' ads, like YouTube did, on completely wrong things. Another area that if we go back to the automaker, one of the big things that people are that the big automakers are promoting right now are technologies of driverless vehicles or driverless technologies, like making sure that the car stays in lane, which is a technology called lane assist. Now, if you go to India or Brazil or China, there are no lanes, and if there are lanes, then they're not accepted in the way you drive, which means that it's an absolutely ridiculous position to take in those markets to say that the car has lane assist, because that doesn't exist in the way that they drive or the way that the roads are made. So there you have a sort of a cultural misunderstanding between a place that has roads and with lanes in them, and where those lanes are accepted as a reasonable thing, yet you have other cultures that aren't like that. So that's another example of just a misunderstanding of what you promote and what you put into a vehicle.
And your solution is the title of your book, Sense Making. What do you mean when you say sense making? How can we develop this skill?
Right. Sense making is just a word I chose for the ability to synthesize several kinds of data in order to understand why we're doing what we're doing. So it would be, in the case of vehicles, it would be sales numbers and algorithms and all those kinds of things in terms of understanding how much and where and so on, but also why people are doing what they're doing. And that's a different sort of skill that maybe comes out of the human sciences, that is about observing and interpreting the world. So the good sense makers that I'm describing in the book, and I'm describing 10 different ones, it's an investor, it's a teacher, it's a conflict negotiator, it's a winemaker, so different sort of people in society that all use this skill to understand the people that they're dealing with. And what is common among them is that they all have a data-driven way of looking at the world, but also a sensitivity to other people, which is something that you can cultivate by engaging with other people, but also engaging with the different kinds of products that our culture have, which would be our songs and our music and our poetry and so on, which is a way to understand each other.
We're talking to Christian Maspier now about his new book, Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about proposals to cut federal funding for the arts and humanities? What link do you see between economic success and the arts? What role has art played in your life? Email us now at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up the conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're continuing our discussion with Christian Maspier, author of Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm.
What advantages do you see from the arts? Do you think the arts help people in other areas of their lives? Do you think the federal government should give funding to the arts and humanities? Email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Lomira. Brian, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today? I got two quick ones real fast. I had a friend of mine who was absolutely brilliant. In the early days of computing, he set up a computer program to float skyscrapers on soft soil. He got to a level of company where they were promoting him, sent him back to college to take humanities courses and leave his engineering basically at the office. And that was the only way he was going to get promoted. The second little story is that Chevrolet spent a lot of time and money setting up Latin America car distributor program with a model that they had, and they brought all the cars down to Spanish speaking countries, and the problem was that they weren't selling. It occurred to no one at all in the marketing area that the car Nova, the Chevy Nova, translated meant actually no go. So there's a real necessity for an understanding of cross-cultural communication, languages in our country, and the capacity for understanding other cultures.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. A couple points there, Christian, and you talk about that advancing in the job. You point out that, yeah, right out of college, say, that computer science degree or engineering degree can pay more, but the people who hit the highest levels a lot of the times and the people who really innovate, a lot of them have humanities backgrounds.
It's rather surprising, isn't it, that when you look at the discourse in the public world right now, I mean, if you listen to what people said on the campaign trail 6 months ago and what they're still saying now, is that if you have a humanities degree, you'll never make any money. Yet, if you look at census data and you look at the top 5% earners in America, three times as many people have a humanities background as computer science background. And there are all kinds of reasons for that, but it is surprising that at a certain level in the big companies of America, you got to be a rounded person. You got to have a very a cultured way of dealing with different cultures, different kinds of people, and so on. Which means that the people that really bubble up to the top are people with a history background or an arts history background, and so on. And also, if you look at the list that I have in the book of the executives, the CEOs, and the sort of the top people of our society with a background in French or history or English or something like that, it's remarkable how many of them are actually, from a world that you wouldn't think they are from. But I think it's the combination of a humanities background with a practical look at the world, or sort of a business savvy look at the world, that seems to be the combination that ends up making the most money in America. And that's not why I'm saying it. It's just a curious fact that it's not the computer scientists that make all the money. It's the humanities people.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brian. We'll go next to Rod on the line in Madison. Rod, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I have a degree in history from the University of Wisconsin. I'm retired. I had a very successful career, spent 23 years in Europe, and my history degree was invaluable. I was trained in history not to know when, but why. And I studied the culture, the music, the art and everything about a country, not just who was the king or queen. And I found I was able to deal very successfully with engineers, with scientists. One comment, Albert Speer, Minister of Munitions under the Third Reich, said one of the reasons Nazi Germany was so horrible was because everybody was trained, as he was an architect, to be totally technical, and they couldn't see the soul of what was coming.
Rod, thanks a lot for that call. A lot there, Christian. What do you think?
Well, I agree that if you want to engage, if you're American and you want to have a successful career in Europe, it is helpful to understand who are the people living there and what's their background and why do they think the way they think. And I think that's what he's talking about here. I think, though, it's important to understand that it's the combination of things. My problem is that the pendulum is swinging so far towards science and technology that the only thing you ought to study if you're, I don't know, 17 years old right now, is science and technology. That's the only thing that will give you a job in the future. And what I'm saying is that's too far. I don't want the other way around, where we're all going to be historians and study English. We need to study a diverse set of things, and we need to be able to work together. And I think that's what he's talking about here, that he could bring the science and technology people a perspective and an understanding of why people are doing what they're doing, and that can lead to great innovations and great sort of technology as well.
Thanks for that call. Christian Maspier is with us, author of Sensemaking, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. Back to our callers now, Mark with us in Rockford, Illinois. Mark, hi.
Yes. Hi. And I think this is an excellent conversation. One of the things that Christian had just mentioned, I think, is so true, is that when you have multiple different types of disciplines that you draw your knowledge from, for example, both my parents were artists. My dad was a commercial graphic illustrator. My mom taught art in grade school. Got a brother who never had any formal other than undergraduate, high school and grade school art, who makes his living, and extremely well as a graphic illustrator. He's worked for most of the major comic book networks and companies, and he's actually a co-creator on a couple of the Cartoon Network cartoons. And what that has given me is it's given an attorney who uses analytical skills a lot. It's given me the ability to draw on different ways of looking at things, which allows me to approach problems from ways that, you know, escape many other people who have been, you know, siloed into one mindset.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. So Christian, an attorney there who says his artistic background lets him approach problems from different perspectives, if I could borrow a term from art.
I would wish we had more attorneys like that. but I think in general, I think he's right on that it's the combination of perspectives and not just one perspective. And if we think that machines, in the case of algorithms and sort of computer science, is going to think for us, we're probably mistaken. And I think what we're doing right now is that we are undermining our future ability to train people, to train our kids and train, you know, people that want to study in university and study in college, to give them other perspectives than just one. And since they're now they're closing down the National Endowments of the Arts and the National Endowment of the Humanities, which are already very small compared to what we invest in technology and science, it's sort of the final blow to a system that delivers these multiple perspectives on things. And that's scary for our companies, and it's scary for our public sector, and it's scary for our kids that they can't get to study the things that that they want to study. Some of them want to study. So I would say that to your, you know, if you're a child, if your daughter wants to study English, or if your son wants to study English and your daughter wants to study medicine, that's all fine. They're all good ways to go into the future. It's not just the engineers and the doctors that would be successful.
Mark, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Dee with us in Green Bay. Dee, hi.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. I wanted to share with you the fact that I'm a retired professor of the humanities. I'm also a writer, so I continue with my work. And when I was a professor teaching my students literature, creative writing, and so on, I found that what they ended up becoming, and increasingly so as they became older, as very sharp and articulate ladies and gentlemen. They were highly persuasive. People, I think, gravitate towards that kind of communicator. And so I feel in any field, if you have someone who can communicate as a poet can, with very concrete and descriptive and persuasive language, success is just around the corner. I also feel that, you know, when we talk about the art of the deal, you have to speak in such a way that you are convincing. You have to understand rhetoric, and you have to understand how, if you want people to be encouraged by your work, it has to be beautiful.
Dee, thanks a lot for the call. We're just about out of time. Christian, briefly, as we wrap up, you said the pendulum has gone in the big data, algorithm, science and technology direction. Are you starting to see it come back toward the middle, where we're using a little of both sides of this?
No, I think it's going in the wrong direction, and that's why I wrote a book about it. I say that, I mean, it sounds like on the debate coming out of Silicon Valley or something like that, that the only thing that will be safe for the future is if our children learn how to code. And I would say, based on the last caller, that I think also reading and writing will be helpful. And that's basically just what I'm saying, is that we can't go away from those skills, and we are right now.
We'll leave it there for now. Christian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Christian Maspier, author of Sensemaking, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. He's the co-founder and senior partner of Red Associates, a strategy consulting company based in the human sciences.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get some advice on getting off to a healthy start in 2018.
We'll find out why health screenings can turn into a burden for older adults and where the middle ground might be.
And a Wisconsin woman shares how she has found peace, joy, and gratitude despite the many hardships and health challenges that she's experienced.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. weekday mornings from 6 to 9. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 6, Kate finds out why revenge isn't always as satisfying as it might seem and what other choices we may want to make instead. That's tomorrow morning after 6, right here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR, and then we'll find out what steps health professionals in Wisconsin are taking to improve the state's vaccination rates. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Happy New Year from all of us at Central Time.